If you wish to become a complete and wise leader, you must embrace a larger view of the Force.
And welcome, everyone. My name is Devor, and you are listening to episode 28 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. A reminder, as always, check out the earlier episodes of this show if you're new here, and make sure to subscribe to keep up with new episodes of the show as they come out. Today's episode is part two of my look at Star Wars Visions. If you've not yet listened to part one, pause this, go to that, listen to that. You'll hear us talk about the first four episodes of Visions, then come back here and listen to the rest. Today, we'll be looking at the final five episodes of Star Wars Visions. So that is The Ninth Jedi, TOB-1, The Elder, La Pinocho, and Akakiri. And joining me once again for that is one of the co-hosts of Bohemian Geek Studies and yet another Star Wars podcast, Colleen McMillan. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, and thank you again for having me. This is so much fun. I was so excited on the rewatch last night. I'm like, oh, dang, we're going to talk a lot tonight.
Yes. Yeah, there is a lot of good stuff in the back half of Visions. And just based on the conversation that we got to have for part one, I have no doubt that we will have an equally really good conversation for part two.
Yes, lots of stuff in these episodes on the rewatch. It's like, oh, they really like backloaded Visions, because like I really enjoyed Village Bride. Obviously, I don't think we talked quite enough about that last time. And the duel, but I found myself really enjoying the back half this time.
Yeah, I think in the back half episodes are the ones where my opinions most changed from first watch to rewatch.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So. And that is something that we will, of course, get into in the meat of this episode about how we thought differently about some of these episodes on the second watches. All right. So obviously this time around, I do not have to introduce you because you have already been introduced in part one. Again, if you have not listened to part one and you want to know who the heck Colleen McMillan is, go listen to part one. We can now here just dive right into the substance of it all. So we are starting with, as I mentioned, The Ninth Jedi. Woo. The Ninth Jedi is one of the things I like about this episode is I think it has a great balance of the deep, heavy Star Wars stuff, like the themes and all that. Plus also just some really bonkers things that happen in this episode.
A man melts via kyber crystal.
Yeah, there's so much, and we'll get into it. In terms of the rewatch effect, The Ninth Jedi was one of those I rewatched. I'm like, man, there's some weird stuff in here. It's very good. Some weird stuff happens.
Yes. This one I'm most excited for. This is my favorite of the short films. And I think it is still there on the rewatch. There were like a couple things I noticed, but it's still really high up on my list.
Yeah, it's a very, very good one. So The Ninth Jedi opens with a narrated opening crawl, essentially, which I really liked. And was one of the things, again, that on the first watch, I obviously paid attention to the fact that there was somebody there telling you a story. But it wasn't until the rewatch, I was like, oh, yeah, this is basically just an opening crawl, but being told to us. And we'll actually get another one of those, too, later on in La Pinocho. So.
Yes. Yeah, I noticed that, too, on my rewatch. I'm like, okay. Okay, more Star Wars-y stuff. That's good.
Yeah. And in this opening crawl, we basically get the premise of the episode, which is that you have this guy by the name of Juro, who is the Margrave of the planet High Islan, which is a great title, the Margrave.
The Margrave, yes. It makes him sound like a villain.
Yes. And we'll actually talk about that, the little kind of story thing with that in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this guy named Juro, and he is the ruler of this planet, and we learn that he has been mining kyber crystals on this planet for the purposes of building lightsabers, and We also get this idea again in terms of, we talked a little bit about this in part one about where these stories are happening in the Star Wars timeline. We get a sense here that this is kind of happening like hundreds of years post what we know.
Yeah, I'd say it's way in the future.
Yeah, basically in this period where the Jedi have kind of well and truly disappeared. So he's basically kind of looking to rebuild the Jedi Order. And he sends out this message to any and all Jedi that might be in the galaxy to come to this aerial temple that he has over the planet, to basically come there to get a lightsaber and to basically join him in his mission to rebuild the Order. Mm-hmm. And that's another visual that I really like. I really like the aerial temple.
Oh, it's stunning. I thought the opening of this one is probably the most cinematic of all of the short films. On the rewatch, I was like, wow, this is absolutely stunning.
Yeah, it's a really, really beautiful setting that they do. And so once we get that narration, we then get to see a single ship flying into the aerial temple. And we get to see a Jedi come into the temple who is somehow named Ethan.
Ethan.
There are Ethans in Star Wars.
Oh, there's lots of interesting names in Star Wars. We get a Dan, too, in this.
Yes, we do. It was like when I first started watching Game of Thrones, and I'm like, there's a Robert? Like, what the hell?
Yes, there is a Robert.
There's an Ethan.
In Star Wars now, there's a Douglas, so that's even
yes.
better.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's the most shocking one.
Oh, Douglas. I love him, too. He's a great character, yes. But wow.
So anyway, Ethan enters this temple, and he finds that there are six other Jedi already assembled there. They have all received the same message that he did, and we get to see him basically play this message. Essentially, we get to see Juro the Margrave, and he's essentially telling them what was mentioned in the opening crawl, which is that he is looking to rebuild the Jedi Order, and he's sending out this message to any Jedi to basically come to his planet and so on and so forth. And basically they get into a whole conversation about Juro and should they trust the message, should they trust him. They heard these rumors that he found kyber crystals on the planet, but they're not really sure about that. And frankly, I don't blame them for not trusting him, because like in the hologram, he straight up looks like Skeletor.
Yeah, he's got a mask on. He looks like a Sith.
Yes.
Dressed in all black.
Yes, he looks very, very suspicious. Yeah, so they're all having this conversation amongst themselves, basically the seven of them, and in terms of trying to parse out what to make of Juro. And as they're having this conversation, a droid emerges.
Huge, freaking huge droid.
A giant droid shows up. And basically tells them, like, yeah, the Margrave, he's kind of this crazy old man. He kind of just lives by himself. And they're basically telling him, oh, just kind of sit around. He'll show up soon.
Right.
We go from there. We cut from there to the surface of the planet. And again, in terms of the pantheon of great visuals, I love the, like, the trebuchets that they have.
Yes. It's kind of like, it looks like an oil rig mixed with a fishing rig.
Yeah.
And then it does the trebuchet thing where it tosses its line. I'm like, what is happening here?
Yeah, that's such a cool visual. Basically, essentially the mining equipment for the Kyber. Mm-hmm. It's very, very imaginative. And then we get our first look after that at Kara.
I love her.
Yes. I mean, as we established in part one, F is my girl. Mm-hmm. But Kara is like chomping at the bit.
Yeah, she's ready.
Yes, yeah.
She's ready to be a hero.
Yeah. So we get introduced to Kara, and also she, like so many characters in Visions, has a wonderful droid sidekick named 4-9s, or I guess 99-99.
Yes.
And I really like here, I think it's also in the very opening bit of the episode, but then you get to also have it here again when we basically see Kara and she kind of goes off on her speeder with her droid. I love the use of Rey's theme. Mm-hmm. That it's in there. It's a little bit in Village Bride also, but it's a little more overt here.
Right. It's like the second coming of Rey.
Yes. Yeah. I love that, the way that they weave that in. And so what we basically learn she's basically kind of watching this Kyber being mined, and then she kind of goes off to her home, and we get to find that her dad, whose name is Zima, I think that's how you pronounce it.
Zima, I think.
Zima, okay, yeah, Zima.
He's hot, by the way.
Yes, he is.
And he's played by Simu Liu, who is Shang-Chi, so that just makes him even hotter.
Yes. Yeah, so we see that her dad is a sabersmith, so he makes lightsabers, and he is essentially the one who is making the lightsabers for the Margrave to give to these Jedi, whom he summoned to his temple.
I thought it was really cool, too, that they actually made him look like a blacksmith.
Yeah.
With the mallet, and he's, like, tempering the Kyber. Because I know a lot of people had a little trouble with the Kyber changing colors for the Jedi. But I'm like, well, Zima says he did something to it, so there you go.
Yeah, that's another thing I should really like. I like that little bit of... Because, I mean, we get a bunch of episodes that do little things here and there with lightsaber lore. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like, we talked a little bit about this in the context of, like, an episode like Tatooine Rhapsody that does a little bit with that.
Yeah.
And then we get even more in this one where, yeah, you have basically the feature of that he kind of designed these lightsabers such that they reflect the user's connection to the Force.
Right. Which is really cool. A visual, too.
Yeah, we get that moment where Kara activates one of the lightsabers and first the blade is clear. Mm-hmm. And then also it's really big.
It's really big.
Granted, not Kare big.
No. I don't think anything is going to get as big as Kare big for a lightsaber.
Oh, God. Going back to our twins conversation.
The twins, everyone.
Yes. And so... Her dad is saying that once Kara is eventually strong enough with the Force, it will get some color. As they're kind of talking about the lightsabers, the ship descends next to their home, and it turns out to have Jedi hunters aboard. There's a moment where they think that maybe these are the Jedi who Juro has summoned, but it turns out to basically be these hunters who have come to... arrest Kara's father, basically, for manufacturing lightsabers.
Big Inquisitor vibes from these guys.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because, again, this is something that we learned there, is that the manufacture of lightsabers at this time is illegal. We get this little moment, again, we'll talk about this in a few minutes when we get to the plot twist that happens in this episode, but we have this moment here where the hunters and Zima have this back and forth where they're basically saying, like, how did you find out about me? Who told you about me? And they have the sign when they say, the one who commissioned you to make them, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you get this moment where you're further questioning Juro, mm-hmm. and to what extent, whether or not this is a trap. And so Zima gives Kara the lightsabers, tells her to run off and take him to the temple while he gets taken away by the Jedi hunters. As they're kind of arresting him, some of them kind of break off and chase after Kara on her speeder. And so we get that, basically, with Kara's trying to race to get to the ships, to get to the temple, while these Jedi hunters are after her.
Incredible chase sequence.
Yes.
Amazing. She pulls some, like, cooler than Luke Skywalker shit on that speeder.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, great speeder bike sequence that we get here. We do get, there's a cutaway back to what's happening on the temple, where the Jedi who have assembled are continuing to question the droid about the Margrave. And one of them asks the droid for proof that Juro has actually built a lightsaber. And the droid then summons on command a box inside which there is a lightsaber. I really like the look of this lightsaber.
Yes, they're all so unique. They're very beautifully wrought. Like, Zima is... a king when it comes to making lightsabers. These things are gorgeous.
Yeah, it's very ornate. It's very almost High Republic-y, mm-hmm. in terms of its aesthetic. I like the little Jedi Order symbol that's on it.
Yes.
For whatever version of the Jedi Order we are currently on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's this really, really ornate and really, really beautiful lightsaber. So from there, we go back to the planet and we get, as we just talked about, that great speeder bike sequence where they're chasing through a forest and one of the Jedi hunters sort of remarks that Kara is strong in the Force.
Mm-hmm. Which means he is too.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great little bit of like show don't tell.
Yes.
And so we get the chase sequence. We get a little bit of a fight sequence that happens on the ice that, again, because I mentioned Rebels so many times in part one,
yes.
Like, on first watch, I immediately got taken back to Sabine on the ice.
Yes. Gar fucking Saxon.
Yes.
I hate him so much.
Yes. And she basically sort of deflects some of their blaster bolts with her lightsaber. And then she has this great moment where she like spins the speeder around and then disembarks.
Yes. She just looks so badass.
Exactly. And then she takes out the hunter who's after her, basically destroying his speeder with her lightsaber. And then from there, she goes to the spaceport in order to get to the temple. Where we get one of the great contributions of Star Wars Visions.
Yes, for the ages.
You want to tell the listeners who we're introduced to here?
Oh my gosh, it is a new droid for our viewing pleasure. He is consuming his oil as tea, as hot tea, and he is just chilling next to all of his bros who are very much deactivated slash asleep. And he might be the laziest droid we have ever met.
Oh,
very nonchalant, very just like, I'm busy. I'm on my break.
I love it. I love, yeah, just the, again, the visual of a droid sipping tea slash oil is just so
perfection.
Great.
So good. The instant I saw him, I was like, I'm sold. I want a show just about this guy.
Yes. And the way he's like, go ask somebody else. And then there's all the
all the broken
droids.
Yeah. They're all busted to hell. And poor Kara's like,
you're all I've got.
Yeah. You're it. You are it.
And so then he basically reluctantly agrees to find cut into his break and take her up to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Kara arrives at the temple and she gives the lightsabers to the assembled Jedi. And the Jedi start questioning her about the Margrave. And she basically says, oh yeah, like I know the Margrave. Like I've known him since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. And like they immediately just cue in on her.
Yeah.
Where they're like, okay, like, well then where is he? And then we get this moment where basically she and Ethan are surrounded by these Jedi. And there's all of a sudden a sense of like, oh no, like
right,
something's about to go down.
Yep. Got a bad feeling about this.
Yes, exactly. And they all activate their lightsabers and the blades are all red.
Whoops.
Yes. Telling us that they are all in fact Sith. Did you see this coming? This twist?
No, I did not.
Me neither.
I'm really glad they did not put this in the trailer because it was fantastic. I loved this reveal. I loved all of the Sith characters, especially their dynamic. Like, they actually seem to know one another and kind of care about each other.
Yeah.
Which is strange for the Sith.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, that they really do seem to be more cooperative than competitive, which is what we generally don't see that when we're talking about Darksiders.
No, definitely not. Like the one guy, the leader, the blonde guy, he seemed very concerned when
yes.
they were like cut down. I was like, all right, well, that's weird. Why aren't you a Jedi?
Yeah, he gets very intense later on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought this moment was great because towards the end of part one, we talked a little bit about when we were just kind of talking about visions in general and the storytelling. We sort of talked about this idea of the story zigging where you expect them to zag.
Yes.
And I thought this was a great, maybe the best example of that out of all of the short films.
I would agree.
Where in the first part, you're getting all this setup to you're looking at Juro and you're like, is he trustworthy? Is this a trap? There's all these little hints sprinkled in of maybe he's not who you think he is.
Right. Like maybe he's a Jedi hunter.
Yeah.
He's trying to bring them all to this planet so that he can destroy them.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you're being led to believe. And then you get to this moment where they turn on all the lightsabers and then it flips all of that on its head.
Yep. You're like, oh, shit. Poor Ethan.
Poor Ethan.
Ethan just shows up. He's in the company of all these Sith who know each other.
Yes.
They're probably looking at him like, who the fuck is this kid who looks like Sasuke from Naruto? Who is he?
And so it is at that moment when the Sith reveal themselves that the droid opens up.
Yep.
And out of it jumps the Margrave Juro.
Fantastic. No notes on the entrance for the Margrave.
Absolutely. Just great.
He's like, haha, I've caught you now. I'm like, yay.
And so it is at that point that basically the fighting breaks loose. He has a really awesome move where he basically takes one of the lightsabers from one of the Sith with the Force.
Yes.
And then you get that great visual of it turning green.
When it hits his hand.
Yeah, when it hits his hand. Yeah, it goes from red to green. And then he just immediately goes and cuts the guy in half. And then you get that, you know, again, that great little visual of the guy basically being sliced in half diagonally. And so then, yeah, as I said, you start having fighting. So you basically got Juro, Ethan, Kara amongst the remaining Sith. And Kara takes out her lightsaber. And so she's sort of fighting alongside Ethan.
He's doing his best, folks.
Yes. Once again, the pilot droid with the great moment where he's just watching. He says, nice moves.
Yep, he's just chilling. He just stayed there. Oh, man.
Keeping his distance.
Yep. Just observing casually.
Yes. And so, yeah, so you've got all this fighting going on. Juro takes out two more of the Sith. So, yeah, you basically get these kind of cuts back and forth between like what Juro's doing and then what's happening with Kara and Ethan. You have this moment where Kara is fighting one of the Sith, this guy named Homan, who's like the big, I don't even know how you would describe like what he looks like.
Like a giant tree sloth, but that can move.
Yes, that's actually, yeah, I actually like
kind
that.
Kind of just like a Lassat, but more sloth-like in the face.
Yes, I like
He's
that.
Big and furry and bulky.
Yeah, and so there's a moment where she's fighting him and their lightsabers are locked. And again, you get to see the lightsabers starting to change. So on the one hand, hers starts getting color. So it starts going from the clear to the green. And then his starts changing too. So it starts going from red to purple.
Yes. I love that part.
Yes. And again, in terms of rewatch, that was something that did not clock on the first watch.
No, me either. I was like, wait a minute, why is he still alive? I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I noticed her changing, but not his changing.
Mm-hmm. His was much more subtle, especially when you're like watching for hers to change. You're not really looking for his.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was something that I did not pick up on until watching it the second time. And so then we get in the sort of in the climax of the fighting, you've got Juro fighting against Rodan, who is the human. I think he's the guy that you were talking about earlier, who's like the really intense guy who's kind of the leader.
Yes.
And you get this moment where Rodan fires some Sith lightning at him, which is red, which is really, really cool.
It looks amazing.
Yes. And then Juro is able to kind of hold it back, but then some of it gets loose and it ends up breaking his mask. So his mask kind of goes flying off a la Am in the Twins.
Yep.
And it's at that point that Kara kind of breaks off her fighting and she goes to help out Juro in his fight. And then we get the moment where you were talking about at the very beginning, where Juro pushes Rodan basically off onto a giant kyber crystal where he is immediately set aflame.
Yeah, for some reason it sets him on fire.
A very intense moment.
Yes. It was like, whoa, Disney.
Yes, of him basically disintegrating.
Fine. He's all good. He's going to be fine, guys.
Just a little bit, just some time in a back to tank, like, he'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Just a few burns.
Yeah, it's okay.
Just a flesh wound.
And so, basically, once they kind of finish up with him, Ethan is still fighting Holman, and Juro tells him, basically kind of beseeches him to stop fighting and says, you know, like, this isn't who you are, give up and stop fighting. And that's that moment that Holman sort of retracts, and he basically says that he got caught up with everyone else.
Yeah, right. Like, that's kind of sus, but we'll let you have it for a little while. Like, we'll, in the sequel, we're going to be watching you.
Yeah, again, that was one of those moments that on the first watch, I was like, wait, what just happened with him?
Yes, that turnover was a little bit quick for me. And I know they had to because this is a short film and they're trying to end the short film. But still, I was like, wait, what?
Right. Yeah. The line that he gives basically is that he got consumed by the darkness of everybody else. Mm-hmm. And that's the hand wavy explanation for what happens. But yeah, it's again, in terms of, as I mentioned at the top of this discussion of some of the bonkers moments of this episode, this is definitely one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, this seemed like a guy that the Margrave knew also.
Yeah.
Like, was this just like one of the Jedi that he knew that he was sending the message to? So he thought that he was Jedi.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It did seem like this was someone he was already familiar with.
Mm-hmm. So in the sequel, we need the backstory, please.
Yes, exactly. And so Juro ends up sort of explaining to Kara that several of the Jedi who had answered his call were killed and replaced by Sith. And so as a result, he hid himself in order to learn who they really were. Basically, whether these people who had arrived were true Jedi or if they were these Sith agents. And it's here that he reveals that it was in the context of interacting with them that they learned about her dad. And that's how the Jedi hunters found out about him and arrested him. So again, kind of giving context to that earlier line at the beginning, when the Jedi hunters mentioned that they learned about Kara and her father from Juro. At the time, we think, oh, is that Juro selling them out? But now we learn, oh, that's because Juro inadvertently let slip who the Sabersmith was. And so he promises that he will help Kara free her father. Because there's one of the Sith at the very beginning, before the fighting starts, mentions that basically the hunters have taken her father far away and that she'll never see him again.
Right. This is Star Wars 4. She will see him again.
Yes.
At least she better.
And so the four of them go off, and this is how the episode ends. They kind of go off to find the other Jedi who are scattered throughout the galaxy. And so we get that great visual of, one, their ship coming out of hyperspace, and then that great rotating shot of the aerial temple where you've got the beam of light coming out of it that's like the lightsaber.
Oh, it was so stunning.
Yeah.
I was very mad when this episode ended.
Yeah, this is definitely at the top in terms of episodes that you want to know more about as soon as you're done, because it feels so much like a setup to other stories.
Like a prologue. Like, this is the 20-page prologue before the story starts.
Yeah, more so than probably any other episode. It feels like it is one that is setting up greater storytelling.
And I'm ready for it.
Yeah. And I think we've even subsequently learned, I think there was an interview or something with the director who said something to the effect of, oh, yeah, he has stories beyond this thought out.
Wow. Give it to him, Disney. Just give it to him right now. We would love it. Please.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, like you said, The Ninth Jedi, it has a very cinematic feel. And it very much has this flavor of a setup to more stories.
Mm-hmm. And that might be because of the animation company that made it. They're one of the bigger studios on the list of creators for Visions. Like, they've done Ghost in the Shell. They've done Haikyuu, which was a really big hit. And they did, it looks like it's FLCL, but it's really Fooly Cooly. And that was a really popular series. So they've been around a while, longer than most of the other anime studios on this list. So I think they're kind of used to this. Like, they're used to the production value. They're used to getting stuff done. They're used to waiting in the wings with more material.
Right.
So it's like, if you were going to give one of these studios free license to go with one of the shorts, I would think Production IG would be high up on the list that Disney would be willing to work with over and over again.
Right, right. Yeah. And yeah, among the episodes that we get in Visions, this is definitely one that I'm very much eager to get more with these characters.
Mm-hmm. I could use a prologue. Like I said, like, what's up with the Margrave? Like, what made him want to do this? How does he know Kara and her father? And then the subsequent journey, like True Grit style, for the girl to like get her justice and yes. chase after the bad guys. Or I got very big Great Mouse Detective vibes for all of my 1980s Disney heads out there. Girl trying to get her father back. Oh, now I need to watch that movie.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of storytelling potential with what mm-hmm. they've set up in this episode.
With Ethan, what the hell is up with Ethan? Who named you? We need to know these things. Like, he's probably from freaking Shandrilla or something.
Oh, God, yes.
Where he's, like, got a cushy life. And he's like, oh, yeah, I got this message. I just jetted out here to the Outer Rim. Like, of course you did, sweetie.
Oh, my God. Oh, I need so much more Ethan background.
Well, and he's voiced by Masioka, who was on the TV show Heroes, and he was Hero on Heroes. Okay. And I love him. I adore him. So if he can get even more voice work, I would be totally fine with that, too.
Yes. So, yeah, just so many characters to learn more about and so much story potential lying there. Mm-hmm.
Even the Sith. Like, I would love to have, like, just an episode of how the Sith all know each other. How they got together. Like, yeah. Who put this band together?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what does this new Sith look like? I mean, clearly it's not Rule of Two anymore, so.
No. Well, and there's got to be a bigger leader. Like, there has to be some sort of leader. Because I don't think he would go wandering into the Margrave's territory.
Yes. Yeah. So,
like,
yeah.
The mini bosses, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's even a lot of storytelling to be told on that end with the Darksiders and this new Sith and all that. Yeah. So that is Ninth Jedi. So now we will move on to the next installment, and that is TOB1 or Toby. I guess we can, that would yes. be the easier way to refer to the episode title anyway. The episode opens with our titular character, TOB1, and we learn that he's basically a kid droid. Mm-hmm. And that he was built by this guy named Professor Mataka, and that he is essentially one of a host of droids mm-hmm. who is basically the worker slash child of Professor Mataka. Mm-hmm. Mataka looks a lot like a video game character.
Yes. Yeah, they are very reminiscent of Astro Boy.
Oh.
Very, very like Astro Boy with the big eyes and just kind of like the, oh, golly gee, like Mickey Mouse kind of situation. And that's one of like the first and most well-known animes and manga made by Osamu Tezuka. And it's pretty entertaining. Astro Boy? Like, you wouldn't, maybe that wouldn't be your first thing you would gravitate toward. But it's very like that. And it's also like, one of my favorite anime movies is Metropolis. And it's from the early 2000s. And it is basically an anime retelling of the film Metropolis, where mm-hmm. there is a synthetic person who is a young girl. And she goes on an adventure with a human boy. And it has a very devastating ending. I'm just going to warn you right now.
Oh, no.
But it's kind of in the same vein of adorable kid who happens to be like a cybernetic being learning how to become real. Very Pinocchio. Also, you have to throw the
right.
Pinocchio, Geppetto.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's a very good point.
In there. But yeah, that kind of style. And it looks very cutesy.
Yes.
Like, I'm sure people were kind of thrown by this kind of old school style character design.
Yeah. And I will say, for the first entry tonight in the dub sub disparity, I will say that TOB1 in Japanese I found to be less, I'm going to be frank, annoying than the English one.
That's fair. That is fair. I did really like the sub with the Japanese original. I thought that actor did a really good job as Toby.
Yeah. And so TOB1, he goes off to go find another droid, CO3, to fix him up. And we get to basically see his room, and we see all of these drawings on the wall where he's got like AT-ATs and X-Wings.
Possibly Obi-Wan and Grievous.
Yes.
Looks like a Wampa.
Yeah, he's basically playing Star Wars in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of wandering around the professor's home, his lab. And at one point, he starts getting close to or around the basement. And Mitaka immediately chastises him for going there. Basically, says, you know, I've told you not to go into the basement. And what we come to learn is that Mitaka and the droids are on this planet, and they're basically working to try and figure out how to bring life to this planet.
Yeah, they're terraforming, or trying to.
Yeah, Mitaka has this line where he says that he's not going to stop until he gets... What is it exactly? I should have written it down. I think it's when he says, when there's rain falling.
Yeah, clouds in the sky, and when plants can grow.
Yes, yeah. And... He also, I like, he had this line because TOB1 starts talking about how he's been for a long time daydreamed about being a Jedi and kind of going across the galaxy and exploring and having all these adventures. And Mitaka has this moment where he has this line where I think it's actually TOB1 who parrots him saying it, where he says that the galaxy, quote, is terrifying and full of danger.
Yes. The night is dark and full of terrors.
I have got written down right there in my notes.
Exactly. Perfect. Yep. Yes, it is, Toby. Yes, it is.
Yes. Yes, very Game of Thronesy.
I mean, he's not wrong.
Yeah.
Considering what happens.
Exactly. And Mitaka also has this really good line where he tells Toby, adventure, excitement, I'm afraid that being a Jedi is not as glamorous as it is in your dreams. Which is definitely a Yoda nod there.
Yes. Yeah, it's a job.
Yeah. Adventure, excitement, a Jedi craves not these things. And so he tells TOB1 that if he wants to become a Jedi, that there's a kyber crystal hidden somewhere on the planet. And that he should go out and find it.
Yeah, make him work. He's not bothering you. This is like a typical parent thing. Like, go on a scavenger hunt and leave me alone.
That's so right. I didn't think about it.
Wow, Professor.
That's such a good point, though.
Oh, he's just like, I need to keep Toby out of the basement. How can I get him to do that?
It's like an Easter egg hunt, essentially.
Where there are no Easter eggs.
Oh, God.
Oh, really, really, really rude.
So, yeah. So, TOB1, he gets on his little speeder, and he starts going around the planet looking for the crystal, and we get this montage of him, like, like the classic trope of hopping on the rocks.
Yeah,
like,
looking under rocks.
Yes.
Looking in the sand.
And he can't seem to find the crystal anywhere. And so finally, as a last resort, he decides, well, I'll check the basement. It's down there. And he goes down there and he finds a ship that looks a lot like the Skyhoppers.
Yeah.
And he goes into it and turns it on.
As a child would. He's like, oh, yeah. Super sweet. There's this ship.
Yes.
Like, oh, balls. What's he going to do now?
Oh, God. And so as he's kind of playing with the ship and all the controls, he ends up sending out a message that gets picked up by a Star Destroyer, on board of which is an Inquisitor.
Yep. Here it comes, folks.
Of all the ships in the galaxy.
Yeah. Oof.
Get the one. And Mitaka finds him in the basement and is, for obvious reasons, quite upset with him.
Yep.
And he pries off the door of the ship using the Force. And that is at that moment that we learn that Mitaka is, in fact, a Jedi. Mm-hmm. We then get a shot. We see troops heading down to the planet. They are in the, I don't actually know the name of the ship, but it's the ship that was in Rogue One.
One of the troop carrier ships?
Yeah, one of the Imperial troop ships that I think mm-hmm. is in that movie. And so Mitaka tells TOB-1 to hide in a wall because he's going to go off and fend off the Imperials. Basically. He knows it's over.
Yeah, he's like, I'm screwed.
And he leaves him in there in the care of CO3, and he also gives him the lightsaber hilt. Mm-hmm. And actually, here we get another Rogue One nod, because as he's sealing him in the wall, Cask of Amontillado style.
Yeah, I was like, oof, thank goodness he's a droid.
He says, I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me.
That line never fails to get to me. If someone says it, I probably will cry.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine.
Yeah. Ahsoka and Siege of Mandalore.
Oof, God, yeah. Yeah. Oof. That one.
And so TOB-1 awakens later on, and he discovers that the lab has been destroyed, mm-hmm. and that Mitaka is dead.
They buried him. I mean, that was nice of them.
That I also wonder, like, yeah, who buried him? It was not Owen and Beru style where they just left.
Right. Yeah, just like skeletons hanging
exactly.
out. Exactly. Wow. They buried him. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So is that moment that TOB-1 basically vows to continue Mitaka's work? Mm-hmm. And so he rebuilds all the droids who got destroyed. He rebuilds the lab. He starts growing different sorts of plants and vegetations in these tubes.
Yep.
And eventually he starts being able to grow them naturally. And then you get the moment where he's able to make clouds and it starts to rain.
Which is very cool.
Yes. Yeah. So at that moment when he kind of fulfills the professor's mission. And it's at that moment that the Kyber crystal that Mitaka was telling him about appears to him. And he uses the Force to assemble the lightsaber.
Huge, huge, folks. A cybernetic being uses the Force.
Yes, yes. Something that we really hadn't seen before. Mm-mm.
They're not supposed to be able to.
Yeah, Force-sensitive droids. And so once he does that, we get the return of, or the arrival of, the Inquisitor.
Who is scary. Like, for how cutesy the rest of the character design is in this film, wow. He's terrifying. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Very big, very menacing, has almost medieval knight vibes. Mm-hmm. And he confronts TOB-1 and they start fighting. And he initially beats him and is able to take him down. And then you get this moment where, again, not unlike in the Twins, where you get this cutaway moment from the action where TOB-1 enters this Force realm.
It's like World Between Worlds hitting us hard.
And he sees Professor Mitaka, and Mitaka tells him how proud he is of him. And you get the knighting ceremony, where he is made into a Jedi. This was, for me, on first watch, very emotional.
Yes. I think this scene is emotional because it's like a dad and a son.
Yes,
he did make Toby, and Toby is a synthetic being, but it's still like his kid. And obviously he could feel, I think, that Toby had some connection with the Force.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, wow, did I like infuse this creation with my force ability or something to that end? Like, this is actually his kid, like for real.
Yeah. And, you know, you were talking about a few minutes ago about the I am one with the force and the force of me line as just being always emotional.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the knighting is, again, one of those, like, it's by the right of the council, by the will of the force, whether it's the first version when we get with Kanan and Rebels, Cal and Jedi Fallen Order, here, whenever that happens, it's like, that hits me.
Yeah, it's gut-wrenching.
Mm-hmm. It is here that he basically goes from being TOB1 to Toby, and he re-engages the Inquisitor, and they continue their fight. So there's basically a bunch of things happen here. So at one point, the Inquisitor chops off one of Toby's arms.
Yes. Because literally his arm comes off, folks.
It's Star Wars. Somebody's got to lose an arm.
Yes. This is a kid show.
Exactly.
Great. He rallies really nicely, though.
He does. Yeah. You get that attack where he basically knocks him into the lab and he turns on all the valves and like all the steam shoots out.
Mm-hmm.
You have all the other droids coming to Toby's aid. And then you have Toby reciprocating the arm chop off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he kills and defeats the Inquisitor. And so the episode ends with Toby getting on board Mataka's ship and basically deciding that he is going to continue the professor's work on other planets. So he's going to go out and help others because he says, because that's what Jedi do.
Yeah. He's finally learned that the true job of a Jedi is to help other worlds.
Yes. Yeah. So he makes that evolution almost a la Luke, a lot like a lot of our heroes in Star Wars, where the starting point is, oh, adventure, excitement, the thrill. And then he gets to the discovery of what it really means to be a Jedi.
Yeah.
So he has that great arc there. And yeah, there the episode ends. It's, again, it's an episode that we talked a lot about this in part one about tone of the different episodes. This one is tonally very distinct. It's maybe, if you kind of put them all on a spectrum, it's maybe close to like a Tatooine Rhapsody.
Yes. It's more on the younger viewer friendly side.
Yes. Yeah. It's got that, like that episode, it's got a lot of the cutesy elements in terms of the design of the characters and also the story. But again, as we talked about with Tatooine Rhapsody, also a lot of dark elements.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, a lot of kids entertainment has anyway. Mm-hmm. We just notice it a lot more when we're adults. And we're like, did we watch this as children?
Oh, yeah.
Yes we did.
Yes, the sheer amount of violence in a, like, Tom and Jerry or whatever else.
All of the cartoons have that kind of hyper, like, not realistic violence.
Yes. And, yeah, that's the episode.
Mm-hmm. This one, I think, is a lot harder to talk about than some of the other ones just because it seems like it's so simplistic and it's a fairly easy A to B plot. But I think a show with Toby would be really cute. I think it would be like a nice segue from like a Rebels or a Clone Wars where not every kid could maybe watch it because they'd be scared, but like maybe Toby could be a more younger kids friendly Star Wars.
Yeah, you can imagine a Toby show being almost a gateway show where a kid might go from that to a, let's say, a Clone Wars or Rebels or the movies or something like that.
Right. Like he gets intrigued, like, oh, this is interesting. I like this. It's a cute robot.
Yes. So, yeah. And yeah, like you said, I mean, relative to a lot of the other episodes, I think this one is much more straightforward in terms of what is going on. There is obviously all sorts of, it's tapping into different lore things, and you do get the interesting element of, here's this robot, the cybernetic being who has this force connection, and what do we make of that, and how does that change how we think about the force?
And how would other people engage with him?
Yeah.
I think would be interesting, and that would be more of maybe an older kid series, like how Toby would have difficulties integrating into a planet that was populated.
Yeah. or even being potentially accepted by other Jedi.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. Imagine if they thought Obi-Wan was too old to be a Jedi when he was, like, what, 3? Can you imagine them getting a droid and being like,
Oh, God, imagine Toby in front of, like, the Phantom Menace Jedi Council.
They'd just be like, get out.
You're done.
Yeah, exactly. Be like,
they don't even test him. They don't even do the weird Ghostbusters test that they do on Anakin.
Definitely not. They just be like, get out.
Mace has no patience for
him. No. Zero. Zero patience for Toby. And he wouldn't call him Toby either. He'd be like, 2-0-1.
Yes, yes, yes. 100%.
Because Mace Windu is a dick, everyone.
You could even imagine him, like the Anakin line, I'm a person and my name is Toby.
Yep. Oh, yeah. It would fit in perfectly there.
Oh, my God.
Justice for Toby, everyone. Yes.
So, yeah, that's that episode. And then we can move on to episode number 3 in our discussion. That is The Elder. Mm-hmm. First things first, in terms of the overall setting of this episode, did you clock that this is supposed to happen in the past?
I guessed that it was in the past just because of their relationship and seeing like them going to the Outer Rim, and Dan's excited to go to the Outer Rim because it doesn't seem like as many Jedi have gone there. Mm-hmm. Like, he's really excited that his master has been to so many planets.
Right.
And I can see it being, like, before or maybe during either High Republic time or, like, right before the shenanigans start to happen mm-hmm. in their prequel trilogy. Or it could be even further back.
Right. Though this is something that on first watch I did not click. I just, for whatever reason, again, assumed it was one of these far in the future stories. Mm. And it was only later on and seeing other commentary about it that I clocked, this is supposed to be happening pre-prequels. Like you said, maybe High Republic, maybe earlier than that.
Mm-hmm. Just because of the Elder, I think that's where people are kind of getting their time frame from. But we'll talk about that when we get to him.
Yes. Oh, yeah. There's a lot to say about the Elder.
There's a lot to say about all three of these guys.
Yes. Oof. So, yeah, as you mentioned, this story centers on these two figures, these two Jedi. So you've got Dan, who is the apprentice, and then you've got Tajin, who is the master. And I love me a good master and apprentice story.
Yes. Sign me up for all of them.
Yes. I mean, these two, you get notes of Qui-Gon Obi-Wan. You've got Loden and Bell from High Republic.
Sarcasm.
Yes. Like, there was, like, immediately when I was watching Dan, I got so many Bell Zedifar vibes.
Yes. I love Bell.
Yes. I love Bell Zedifar. So maybe that's why my brain immediately went to him. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love any kind of story like this where you've just got master and apprentice. They're on a journey and it's them kind of figuring each other out. And yeah, like you mentioned, they're trading barbs and quips and
being adorable, basically.
Yes.
Like, you get attached to these two really quickly.
Yes. And, of course, the traditional dynamic where you've got the apprentice who's just very eager and exuberant and got a lot of energy and just wants to get out there. Mm-hmm. And the master's like, oh, you hold your horses. Like,
yep. But also, I'm not that old.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I love the dynamic so much.
It's really good.
It's so fantastic. And the two English voice actors, they could probably play these characters in live action. David Harbour plays Tajin, and he's Hopper, of course, from Stranger Things, and Red Guardian from Black Widow.
Yes.
So the voice doesn't quite match what you would think of him as an actor. But
yeah.
I kind of want to see him as a Jedi now. And then Dan is Jordan Fisher, who is a TV and Broadway star. He's basically like 18 heartthrob extraordinaire. He would be great in Star Wars, and I could totally see these two like duking it out verbally as master and apprentice.
Yes, totally.
Even though Tajin is more like the long flowing black hair, like Aizawa from My Hero Academia, immediately was like, oh, Aizawa's a Jedi. That makes sense. Love, love, love their dynamic so much. I think I got attached to these two quicker than any other characters.
Yes. Yeah. This is one of those story elements in Star Wars that it's sort of like the sassy droid, which is like, you can just keep giving it to me and I will never get tired of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Sign me up.
Yes. Yeah. There's no diminishing returns from this trope in Star Wars.
Exactly.
And Tajin has this great line when they're on the ship traveling through hyperspace going into the Outer Rim, where he tells Dan, the seeds of misfortune when in peaceful soil can be easy to overlook. Mm-hmm. Which to me gave a lot of prequel trilogy vibes.
Yes.
Because it's sort of a nod there, like, oh, this peaceful planet, Naboo. And it turns out from there you get the senator who turns out to be the person behind it all.
Mm-hmm. The well of evil, everyone.
Yeah, I thought that was a great line, basically a kind of warning that he gives to Dan about needing to always be on the lookout for threats.
Yep.
And so as they're traveling through the Outer Rim, they sense this dark presence through the Force. And so immediately they're trying to figure out, what is it? Where did it come from? Tajin insists that it can't be the Sith because he says they've been gone for hundreds of years.
Yeah. Check your hubris. You just were telling Dan to, like, be on the lookout.
We got old Ki-Adi Mundi here.
Ooh, yes. God damn it. When he said that, I was like, oof, oi. Like, not this old chestnut again.
Yep.
Damn, Jedi.
And so they decide, based on what part of the Outer Rim that they're in, they decide to go to the only inhabited planet in this region, which is a planet called Habbo, reasoning that this is probably the only place that this presence could have come from. And so they land on this planet, and they go to this little village. And Tajin tells Dan basically to hang back. He says he's going to go into this village. He says that the inhabitants of the planet are very shy, so he's just going to go in as one person. And so as he goes into the village and starts talking to some of them about, you know, questioning about this presence, we get to see Dan in a very adorable moment.
So cute.
Befriending some of the village children who are kind of hiding and kind of looking at him. And yeah.
It's so cute. He's proving basically that he will be a good Jedi who does leave the temple and goes and travels the galaxy. He's kind of proving his mettle that he can make friends with people and make inroads in societies that might not welcome them initially.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I totally agree. Yeah, it sort of speaks to his warmth and compassion. Mm-hmm. And yeah, even Tajin kind of comments on that when he returns. He's like, oh, like, you've already gotten the kids to open up to you. And so when he returns, he tells Dan that he has learned that a few days earlier, an unknown old man had shown up to the village in a ship, who the villagers assumed to be from a foreign tribe. And that subsequent to landing, he ended up going off by himself into the mountains that are nearby the village. And so it is at that moment that the two decide that they are going to split up. And so Tajin goes off to investigate the old man's ship to see what he can learn there. And then Dan decides to go into the mountains.
After telling Tajin that he's old. Old and infirm, can't go up the mountain.
Go up the mountains, yeah. When he's insisting that his line about, like, oh, you're better with ships and I'm better with mountains.
Yeah. And I'm like, Tajin's maybe like 35. Chill out, Dan.
Yes. And yeah, even, you know, Tajin has this line about, like, do you want to go to the mountains because you think you're more likely to run into him? Again, speaking to that, some of that Padawan exuberance, the itching for the fight.
Yeah.
And Tejin warns him before he goes off about these wild animals that live out in the mountains called the Vamga. And basically to kind of look out for them. And again, we get a sort of another nod to that with Dan, where he's talking about, he's warning about the animals and how basically saying, well, if you don't engage them, they'll leave you alone and all that. Mm-hmm. And he basically says, well, if they attack the old man, then it's lightsabers out. So again, mm-hmm. like he's spoiling for the fight.
Yeah. He's ready. Well, he thinks he's ready.
Yes. Yeah. And so Tejin ends up going off and he finds the ship. And he tells Dan over comm that it looks like an old Sith ship. Mm-hmm. It's reminiscent in its design. And Dan, meanwhile, is going through the mountains. He has the line where he's like, how could an old man go through this by himself?
Right. Like, it's like underestimating old people and young people all in one episode.
Yes, like he can't fathom his master managing these mountains.
Yeah, nice.
And so Dan eventually comes across one of these animals that Tejin warned him about, this Vamga, but it's dead. And it has had its throat slit. And so when he tells Tejin about that, Tejin tells him that only a lightsaber would be capable of slitting the throat of a Vamga. Mm-hmm. Again, indicating that this old man is somewhere nearby. And so Dan at that point basically decides that he's going to regroup and get back together with his master. And it's as soon as he turns that he runs headfirst into the titular elder. And the elder in the English version is voiced by James Hong.
Amazing.
Yes. Who voiced in Star Wars, he's the voice of Asmorgan in Rebels.
Yep.
And he is another, to borrow something that you said in part one, he is very much another that guy.
Yes. He's in everything.
Yes. And honestly, I gotta say, James Hong as the Elder is, for me, one of, if not the strongest English performance in Visions.
Yes, I agree. He's very used to voice acting.
Mm-hmm.
He's used to Star Wars. And he's just old hat at this. Like, he's in Mulan, the original Disney mm-hmm. animated Mulan. He knows what he's doing. He knows his character. And this performance was basically flawless.
Yeah, in terms of what, you know, what he gives versus the kind of original Japanese version of it, like mm-hmm. there's something in his performance that is viscerally unsettling.
Yes, mocking and yes, like he's unsettling. Like, this guy's going to fuck me up.
Yeah, I don't know if it's about, I mean, part of it is, as I mentioned, his performance and his voice and all that. And then there's also something about like the fact that he's got this placid, almost smiling look a lot of the time, mm-hmm. but you know he's a bad guy.
Yes. And he may look harmless.
Yeah. And there's a really interesting moment where Dan asks the Elder if he's a Sith. Mm-hmm. And the Elder replies, quote, "The Sith became far too obsessed with trying to outwit each other. Mm-hmm. It resulted in them completely neglecting their destiny."
Yep.
Which again kind of hints at basically ex-Sith potentially for the Elder.
Right. And the second mention of obsession in yes. this film.
Yeah.
Themes, everyone. Themes.
Yeah. So it's sort of like, and if you compare it to like the first episode with the road and the duel, it's like it's two examples of fuck the Sith, but in different direction, you know?
Yes, one broke kind of good.
Yes.
And the other one broke real bad, folks.
I was like, yeah, they weren't bad enough.
Like, right, exactly. Like, this guy, this elder is, like, traveling from planet to planet trying to get something to kill him. Like,
essentially.
Like, that's the only thing I can think of. Like, what else is he doing? He's
yeah.
looking for something that can kill him. And he hasn't found it yet.
Exactly. So he and Dan end up fighting, and he, as they're fighting, the Elder comments that Dan is not as strong as he thought, because mm-hmm. he mentions that he sensed this presence of someone who was powerful in the Force, and he's realizing, oh, it's not you.
Child.
And then Dan is, you know, trying to basically be like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm stronger than you think.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good try, kid.
Again, yeah, that Padawan exuberance. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, of course, the Elder is too strong for him. And again, I should comment on this in terms of design. The Elder's lightsabers.
Oh, so cool.
Very cool. The dual katana style.
Mm-hmm. Lightsaber. His cross guard is like part of the beam.
Mm-hmm.
It like sparks out as part of the beam. Not quite like Kylo Ren's cross guard, but it looks really cool.
Yes. Yeah. His lightsabers are really, really cool looking. And so he ultimately, of course, bests Dan and he cuts him down, but Dan is not dead.
No, thank goodness. I was worried yes. to lose my shit.
Yes. Yeah. I had a moment too, where I thought on the first viewing, I'm like, oh no.
It's like, please do not kill Dan.
Yes. Tajin ends up finding his way to the Elder and the two of them start dueling. I liked the effect of the lightsaber sizzle in the rain. Mm-hmm.
Yes. With the steam coming off of it.
Yes.
That
nods
to detail.
Yes. Nods to the Tartakovsky Clone Wars,
mm-hmm.
where we get that too. And so the two of them fight. You get the Elder, again, some more force lightning we get to see where he fires some at Tajin. And again, like to get to that menacing quality of the Elder, the way that he kind of looks, the way his face kind of scrunches as he goes. And even his, like, his eyes, I didn't comment
his
on that
eyes
earlier.
Have the red gold theme.
Yes.
He's got the evil eyes, folks. And then he also has rotting teeth, which usually signifies villain. Yes. In this kind of thing.
Exactly. So yeah, so he fires off this torrent of force lightning at Tajin. And then we get the great move, basically the finishing move of the duel, where Dan sends his lightsaber flying off at the Elder. And the Elder is able to flick it away, kind of deflects it. But it distracts him long enough for Tajin to stab the Elder.
Such a cool move, because he extinguishes his saber, goes in for the move, and then relights it.
Yes. Very reminiscent of Last Jedi with Kylo, mm-hmm. when he kills the Praetorian Guard. Very similar sort of move. You just quickly turn on the lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, basically stabs him through the heart. And the Elder, as he's laying and dying in his final moments, he takes out this little detonator and he blows up his ship and then subsequently disintegrates into stone.
Right? Did he like bite a cyanide capsule or something?
I
was very confused by that, but really good to get rid of any evidence.
Yes.
Which I assume is what he was doing.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And sort of we get a hint of that in the next scene. So in the aftermath of the duel, Tajin and Dan kind of start talking about the Elder. He brings up about the destruction of the ship and basically saying that that kind of erased any sort of evidence or information about who the Elder was or where he came from.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically telling Dan, because Dan mentions like, well, like you beat him, so like you must have been stronger than him. And then Tajin points out that if he'd fought the Elder in his prime, he would have lost.
Right.
And so he says, he has a great line where he says, quote, "What defeated the Elder in the end was not me, but time. He couldn't win against the weakness that comes with age. No matter how powerful you become, know it will not last forever." And again, here I thought very much of what came to mind immediately was Palpatine.
Mm-hmm.
The person who is trying to seek and retain power forever.
Yeah.
And yeah, Tajin with this moral of you inevitably lose it over time.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to hold on to it forever.
Right. Which is a good lesson to teach Dan. He's like, you're becoming stronger. I'm becoming weaker. That's how it is. This is the circle of life.
Yeah. And yeah, you just refer to the other great line that he has in this moment where he says, I'm also becoming weaker and you shall continue to get stronger. And so I think in a lot of ways, you know, Star Wars does this a lot in a lot of contexts in terms of the multiple meanings of titles. So in this episode, you've got, obviously it's called The Elder, And he's referring first and foremost to this Darksider, but is also in certain ways referring to Tajin also.
Yes, because he is Dan's elder.
Yes. And so, yeah, it's this story about growing up and getting older.
Mm-hmm. And about teaching kids that that is going to happen.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, and the inherent fleetingness of things like power.
Mm-hmm. So it's not something you should seek. Like, yes, you should become the best that you can be, but don't make that your entire pursuit.
Yes, exactly. Because
yeah, you'll turn into the old man looking for some monster to kill you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, that's the end of the episode.
That one was pretty short and sweet. I'm also curious to see what those two would get up to on their next adventure in the Outer Rim. Especially since Dan thinks it's going to be so boring.
Exactly.
I just really liked their rapport. And even if they were only like in short films or in novels, maybe even, I'd love to spend more time with them.
Yeah, and, no, and me too.
Get to know what time in galaxy they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so much of this episode had very Phantom Menace vibes,
mm-hmm.
which is because, of course, the Phantom Menace opens with Obi-Wan sensing something elsewhere elusive. That's how this episode starts. So mm-hmm. this master and apprentice who are on this one journey, this one mission, then they end up getting pulled into something much larger and making this discovery about this hidden evil that is out there in the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Although I'm sure the council wouldn't believe him, so that's fine.
Exactly.
He'd be like, no, really, it was a Sith. And they're like, oh yeah, well, where's the body? He's like, well, you see, that dissolved. Oh yeah, what about his ship? That exploded.
Oh yeah.
So even though, like, this elder was being like, fuck the Sith, he also was keeping his identity a secret. And
yes.
Hiding the fact that there were active Sith.
Yes, yeah. There is, yeah, there's a lot of mystery surrounding him. And maybe some subsequent story might be the two of them continuing that investigation.
Ooh, that'd be cool.
Of trying to figure out who this elder was, where he came from. Is he a Sith? Isn't he? What is he?
Right. Try and trace things back to him. Try and trace things back to the Sith.
Yeah.
That'd be so cool. I'm here for it. Yay. Detective Jedi.
Yes. That's, again, another great trope. Give me, mm-hmm. give me a Detective Jedi story. I would love that.
Yeah. We're not mad about it. Come on.
Yeah. So this is one of those episodes that I just talked about towards the top about the effect of rewatch and how that changed. Like, this wasn't an episode that I disliked or anything like that on the first watch, but I think I came to appreciate it even more on the second watch in terms of cueing into whether it's the dynamic of Tajin and Dan, whether it's the voice performance of the elder and all that.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to appreciate, and the design of the characters is great. The design of the episode is really great. It's kind of simple compared mm-hmm. to some of the other productions. But I think the strength lies in the character design. They're all very distinct and very memorable looking.
Yes.
Especially Tajin and the Elder.
Mm-hmm.
I just was very blown away by it. I wasn't expecting a lot. And then I heard all the voices. I'm like, ooh, this is going to be good.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's a really strong episode, and yeah, among my favorites of all the shorts. All right, so on that note, let us move on to the second to last episode that we'll be talking about, and that is La Pinocho. We get another narrated opening crawl,
mm-hmm.
and we basically learn in the opening crawl that the Empire has arrived to this planet called Tau in order to help it industrialize. So we learn that the residents of Tau have this deep connection to nature, but that they haven't been able to advance much technologically or industrially. And so the Empire has shown up to kind of hurry that along.
Mm-hmm. Very like Lothal.
Yes. Oh, yes. Major Lothal vibes in that regard. I love the surfing Star Destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
It just crashes into the water.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes. That's kind of like a lot of the ships in Cowboy Bebop. Well, especially the Bebop has like a boat quality to it where it can land in water. So this is like, oh, this is so cool.
I really like that. It's, again, one of those examples. There's several of these throughout Visions of where they're just taking that artistic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
That because they're not tethered to all the conventional Star Wars rules or to canon or whatever, it's like, yeah, let's just do this.
Yeah, they ran with it. You can definitely tell in the design of everything in this episode. Very intricate.
Mm-hmm.
Very involved.
Yes.
Pretty sure I see a Meluron fruit.
Oh, man.
In the shopping stall scene. I think it's a Meluron that she's looking at. It's like, oh, these guys really paid attention.
Yes. And so we learn that, yes, the Empire's here on Tau. They have helped build factories and all that, but in the process they have been using up Tau's natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are setting up what is going to be basically the central point of tension and conflict in this episode. And so we get the shot of this city market, and we are introduced to Lop here, and she's basically running through, kind of hopping on the roofs and all that, and we see that she's wearing this neck collar.
Mm-hmm.
Basically indicating that she is a slave. We get this great shot. We get the kind of wide shot of this city that it's happening, and we get to see in the distance the Imperial base. Mm-hmm. And we get that wonderful shot of the Star Destroyer that's kind of docked in it. And I love basically that you have these cherry blossoms at the base,
mm-hmm.
being the only sign of nature amidst all of this machine and these factories and metal. I really, really like that. Again, to go back, this is something we talked about a little bit with Village Bride, but it's even more so a theme here about this, the dichotomy of nature and technology being a big part of this episode.
It's huge here. So big in this episode. And for all three of the main characters, it has a different meaning.
Yeah, so I like that, where you get that that little bit of nature that is still clinging on,
mm-hmm.
amidst this Imperial juggernaut.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lop is going through these markets, through these food stalls, and she goes in to try to steal something to eat. And she is stopped by Yasaburo, the patriarch of one of these clans on Tau.
Yes, one of the rich people.
Yes, one of the rich people and his daughter Ocho. And Ocho invites Lop to join their family.
Very quickly.
Very quickly.
She's like, I like the bunny girl, though, Dad.
Not unlike Phantom Menace Anakin.
Yes.
Like, you just think about Anakin just walks into their home, and he's got these three people, and he's like, these are my friends, Mom.
Yeah, poor Shmi's like, oh, do I need to get the taser?
Exactly. Here's this like older guy, this droid, like what?
And a teenage girl.
Yes. And Yasaburo is initially opposed to inviting taking on a daughter, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
And Ocho kind of gives him a hard time, basically saying like, "Oh, like you always talk this big game about helping other people, and here's someone who you could help." And so they go to this beach to kind of go and play in the water. We get a dank ferric.
Yes. I clocked that immediately. I was like, ooh, curse word.
Is this our first dank ferric outside of Mandalorian?
I think so.
It could be.
I think it might be. There might be another one possibly in the Bad Batch. I'd have to go rewatch.
Yeah, I don't know if it's shown up in some errant comic or whatever, but
maybe,
it might be.
Yeah, in one of the books maybe, but definitely originated, at least from what I've seen, from Mando.
Yes. And so as they're on the beach and they're playing in the water, they remove Lop's neck collar. Their little droid does it with his little
droid.
with his little tool. Mm-hmm. And they take this family photo on the beach.
I'm sure that won't be important later.
Exactly. It's totally not a setup to something terrible happening.
No.
So from there, we get a time jump. We go 7 years into the future. And we see Yasuburo trying to destroy the Imperial base we saw earlier. This is at the point where, at long last, 8 of 9 episodes into Visions, my knowledge of Dragon Ball finally came in handy. Because, as I have in my notes, Lop has a scouter.
Vegeta, what does the scouter say about his power level?
It's over 9,000!
I clocked that immediately.
Yay! You're like, anime!
Yes. And so we see Yasuburo and Ocho getting into a fight at the base. We learn that Yasuburo is opposed to the Imperial occupation.
Mm-hmm.
He has this comment where he says, we did fine without the Republic. Why do we need the Empire? They're destroying the planet. Mm-hmm. And Ocho is very pro-Empire, and she believes that the Empire can help modernize the planet and give it all these resources and make it better.
Right. Industrialization, basically.
Yes. And you've got Lop essentially in the middle of this.
Who just wants to have family dinner.
Yes, exactly. She just wants them to be a happy family again. And the two of them, Lop and Ocho, leave. They go off in a speeder and they're kind of going down this highway. And they're talking about, Lop is basically saying how she wants them all to get along and try to get to understand their father's point of view. And Ocho's saying, well, he's wrong. This is better for all of us if we go along with the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And they are stopped on the way in this roadblock by these Imperials. And you get this very swarmy looking Imperial officer.
Yeah, I want to punch him in the face.
Oh, God.
So hard. I was like, Lop, drop kick his ass off that bridge.
Yes, just so slimy looking. And he confronts the two of them and he reveals that Ocho had reached out to them about Yasuburo to try and stop his attacks, so that she has basically been covertly cooperating with the Imperials behind everyone's back.
Right.
And it's at that moment that Ocho decides to join the Imperials.
Dun, dun, dun.
And we get this very dramatic moment where she paints her eyes with her blood and she cuts off the family braid. She cuts her hair short.
Saying that she's not in the family anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, severing the ties with the family. And Lop is, of course, very distraught by this. She begs Ocho not to do it. And she ends up going off with the Imperials.
Yes.
And so Lop, obviously quite distraught, she returns back to the Yasuburo compound, the home. She only finds her father there. Her father tells her that everyone else had fled and abandoned. They got scared of the Empire. They didn't want to get caught up in anything. It's at that moment that Yasuburo tells Lop that he has something to show her, something to give to her. And so they go off into this ceremonial room, and he shows her the family lightsaber.
Also very beautiful.
Very beautiful. Again, very, very ornate lightsaber. It's in this box, much like in Ninth Jedi. And he explains to her that this lightsaber was passed down through the generations, which, again, is very interesting in terms of if we think about lightsaber lore. Obviously, there's a little bit of nods to the Skywalker saber. Your father wanted you to have this, even though he really didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He was burning on the shore of Mustafar yelling, I hate you.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, no, I'm pretty sure he wanted to keep that.
Yeah, so you've got the hint of this, that kind of parallel of this totem that gets passed down through the family. But again, also very interesting in terms of the implications of, okay, here is this family that has this lightsaber that's trained the ways of the Force, but of course, they're a family.
Right.
So it's not conventional Jedi where they don't have attachments, they don't get married, they don't raise children of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it raises this interesting question about, are they Jedi? What's their lineage? Were they once Jedi some long time ago and then some ancestor broke away and then the lightsaber just remained in the family?
Right.
Again, like with so many of these episodes, there's so much happening below the surface.
Yes, there is so much here. Like, we're back to the found family. We're back to what does family mean to different people who are inside the same family? What does protecting your family look like?
Exactly. And Yasuburo has this line when he gives Lop the lightsaber. He says, as it is bestowed upon you, remember that even though we are not bound by blood, you and I share a strong connection.
Mm-hmm.
Which there's a line towards the end of the episode that connects to this also. But again, speaking to those Star Wars themes about bonds between people and those bonds transcending familial lines, transcending blood.
Right. Like, you are my family. Even, like, I'm sorry if I was ever rude to you before.
Yes.
Like, but you're my family.
And Lop ends up accepting the lightsaber. So at that moment, Yasuburo goes off. Yeah, he doesn't mention why. We subsequently learn why, where and why he's going.
He's like, stay at home, please.
Yes. Lob ends up returning to the Imperial base. She sees this explosion in the distance. So she sees that something is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes off to see what's going on. And she sees all this fighting that is happening in the hangar. I think we get to see somewhere in there, we see, I don't know, are they dark troopers? I don't know if they were that.
Or it kind of looked like they were.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if they were that or if they were the training droids that Thrawn has in Rebels.
Oh, yeah. It could be those too.
Yeah, so we see Yasuburo and I guess some of the remaining allies that he has fighting there. I will now, for the second episode in the row, I will have to get an extended sentence to my term in horny jail added because Imperial Ocho. Goddamn.
These walls are funny. First you hate them, and you get used to them. Enough time passes, you get so you depend on them. That's institutionalized.
She looks good.
She does.
She traded her traditional familial garb for an Imperial uniform, and she does look really good.
She's rocking it.
Yes. Plus she has that, like, it's kind of like a Manriki weapon, with the chained weapon.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. Like, she obviously knows how to fight. And her dad obviously knows how to fight. He's got the Sai.
Yes.
They're, like, super large and look like they might be vibroblade Sai, which is really cool.
Yes.
Like, everybody's weapons in this just look awesome.
Yeah, really good. And I mean, going back to, we talked about this all the way at the beginning when we were talking about the duel, just the way that they blend the Star Wars aesthetic with the Japanese aesthetic.
Right. Well, yeah. And it's just like their house was so stunningly beautiful, obviously traditionally Japanese, built into nature, built into the mountainside.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know if we mentioned this yet, but his story and the family crest is the crane with the star.
Yes.
And that's the Jedi symbol.
The Jedi symbol, yes.
Like, so cool. All of the symbolism in this episode is just beautiful.
Right, right. And yeah, Ocho and Yasuburo are fighting. Ocho defeats her father. She blinds him in his one remaining good eye.
Rude.
Yes. And you have this very heart-wrenching moment where Ocho essentially disowns Lop and says that she's not really part of the family.
Right.
I think it's after she learns that Lop has the lightsaber.
Yeah. Like, you said you weren't part of the family anymore when you cut your braid off, so.
Yes.
Can't have it both ways.
Exactly. And Ocho goes in basically to deliver the kill blow to her father, and Lop activates the lightsaber and stops him.
Mm-hmm.
And Ocho has this line where she says, what are you doing with that? I'm the successor.
Mm-hmm.
which to me immediately rang the bell of Kylo and Force Awakens.
Yes.
That lightsaber, it belongs to me.
Mm-hmm.
So these two fallen members of the family still attaching importance to these symbols,
mm-hmm.
to these totems of their families. And Yasuburo has the great line, again, connecting back to earlier ideas and things that come up early in this episode, where he says, inheritance has nothing to do with blood. There is so much that matters more.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, is very Star Wars.
Yes.
One thinks immediately of Rey Skywalker or things like
yes.
that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't hold up the familial ideals, then why would he give it to you?
Yes.
Like, it just, she's obviously very delusional.
Yes. And then again, you get another kind of this powerful moment where Ocho cries out, what is family? And she destroys the little droid.
But I was not okay.
No, that is showing the little hollow of them at the beach.
Yes. The and emotional just manipulation didn't work this time.
No, it did not. Oh, God, that's a good point. It did not work this time.
Right. And she knows what she's doing. Like, Ocho knows that she's destroying Lop's best friend.
Yes. Yes. Which Lop immediately reacts to. She goes on the offense. And she takes out Ocho. She does the slash across her chest.
Mm-hmm. Double slash, yeah.
Yeah, the double slash and takes her out. Which I think is really interesting because it goes back to, again, this what I was talking about a few minutes ago about the Yasuburo family and how do they have this lightsaber and their connection to the Jedi and such. Because it's not a very Jedi move.
No.
Because Lop is very much acting out of anger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was something on the first watch, I immediately cued in. I was like, that's really interesting.
Well, and Lop doesn't know. I mean, she uses the Force.
Mm-hmm.
But she has, like, I don't think at least has any idea what it is or how she's doing it. It's more like an instinctual thing.
Right, right. Yeah, she defeats Ocho, but Ocho ends up on top of this Imperial ship. Looking great. Surely nothing can take her down.
No, she's pissed too.
And she flies away. And then we get the final shot of the episode. We go back to the droid where it's playing the broken hologram, where we get to hear Ocho saying about how now they're going to be this family.
Oof, what a way to end.
Ooh, yeah. A real, real gut punch ending.
I would love to see the next installment of this. I like the idea of it being two sisters and the idea of playing around with family and what it means to be family, what it means to be an alien on a mostly human world. Because Lop, we really haven't seen any of her species before in Star Wars, except for Jackson, who is a bunny character also in Star Wars, and their race is called the Lepi, which is a Latin root for lepus, which is rabbit. So they're called the Lepi, and that's the only one we've ever really seen. And now we have Lop, and I would just like to know more about their people and how she became enslaved and what made Ocho go this way, because she seemed really cool.
She did.
And now all of a sudden it's like 7 years later and she's a company corporate stooge.
Pretty much.
I want to know.
Yeah, and I want to see the story of Lop going after her sister and trying to get her back and reuniting this family.
Yes, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, again, another episode with a lot of potential to leapfrog into other stories, both backwards and forwards.
Mm-hmm.
I think even as we talk a little bit about like the history of the Yasuburos and what is their relationship to Jedi and how did this lightsaber come to end up in their family and get passed down and all that.
Right. That would be cool to see it kind of like a Tale of the Three Brothers style animation from Harry Potter. That would be so cool.
Good call. That would be really cool.
And then you could tell the story very quickly and very stylistically without having to get too crazy.
Right. So yeah, that's La Pinocho.
That one also climbed my ranks pretty high on this rewatch.
Yeah, it's a really, really strong entry. And now we move into, last but not least, Akakiri. Mm. So, Akakiri opens. We see this B-wing falling out of the sky, crash landing onto this planet. Out of it emerges our main character, a Jedi by the name of Tsubaki, who is wearing a pretty cool hat. I will give him that.
Yes.
Continuing the entry of Star Wars characters in ponchos. And he fights off these oncoming attackers, basically these warriors who are on these ostrich-like animals.
Very cool. I like the ostriches.
Yes, and he's taking them down one by one, but then he winds up getting plagued by these visions as he's fighting. He's seeing these kind of faint shadows. It's very unclear.
Yeah.
And that ends up basically taking him out of the fight. And he then later wakes up in this cave where we find out that he's been rescued by Misa. And we learn that she is or was a princess, and that her father, who was the ruler of this planet, that he was overthrown by Masago, who was a Sith Lord.
His sister.
Yes. Yeah, they learn about the discovery that there was a Sith Lord in the ranks of the royal family. And so what we learn is that Misa, along with these two guides.
Yes, very Hidden Fortress, old guys played by George Takei and Kyun Young.
Yes.
As very much old guys.
Yes, Kamahachi and Senshu. That they're on this journey to get back to the royal palace to infiltrate it, to take out Masago. And Tsubaki decides to join them. We get this whole montage of them. They're going to these different villages. They're going along. They're going through the forest. And they're making their way. And at one point, they end up getting stuck. And Tsubaki suggests going through this mountain pass. And the guides immediately warn against doing that. They claim that the mountains are, as they describe it, quote, the place of the gods.
Right.
And that essentially the mountain path is cursed and that no one who's gone through it has ever returned. Misa essentially says, we'll pay you extra if you do this. And they agree. I got very, particularly on rewatch, I got very Fellowship of the Ring vibes here.
Yes, completely, very Tolkien.
It's very The Mines of Moria and Gandalf being like, no.
Yeah.
Do not go through Moria.
Yeah, fuck that. We're not going down there.
I know what's down there.
Yeah, exactly. Except I would trust Gandalf way more.
These two guys.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, they end up deciding to go on the cursed mountain path.
It's fine.
It'll be fine. What's the worst that could happen? It's Star Wars.
It's only cursed. It's fine.
And as they're going through the mountains, one of the guides, Kamahachi, goes missing. And Senshu insists that this is divine punishment for them going through the mountains. He's basically saying, he says, I told you so.
Yep.
The mountain is cursed and here is, we're paying the dues.
Yeah, we gotta go.
And Tsubaki immediately protests and he replies, nothing is predestined.
Yes.
Because Senshu is saying that, oh, we made this choice and he was fated because of that to disappear. And Tsubaki says, no. They make their way through the mountains. They wind up at this village where there's this celebration taking place. And there they are reunited with Kamahachi. So it turns out that he did not, in fact, nothing bad happened to him on the mountain. He's all right.
Tsubaki got him. He found him.
And they get paid.
Yep.
They get their money. And Tsubaki here, as they are resting and before they're about to go into the royal palace, ends up getting his visions again. Only this time, compared to the first time we see him, it starts to get a little clearer. And so the next thing that happens, we see Misa and Tsubaki entering the royal palace. They take out some of the palace guards. And we get this, once again, we get this cutaway in the midst of the action. We get this flashback to when Tsubaki was essentially Misa's Jedi protector.
Right. Very Obi-Wan and Satine vibes here.
Yeah, Obi-Wan and Satine, Anakin and Padme, and essentially the two of them having this conversation. And then we go back to the present, and they're making their way through the palace, and they are confronted by Masago. In the English iteration, she is voiced by Lorraine Toussaint.
I love her.
Yes, who I know as Shadow Weaver in She-Ra.
Okay, and she was also in Orange is the New Black as the villain, one of the villains.
She is one of those instantly recognizable voices.
Mm-hmm. Very deep and resonant.
As soon as I heard, I was like, that's Shadow Weaver.
Yes. She's so fantastic. And this, she's great in this role.
And we see that she has the two guides captured. Mm. And she and Tsubaki fight. Tsubaki has another attack, another episode. Mm-hmm. And Masago has this line where she tells him, he was always going to die because it was written. There is nothing that has not been fated.
Oof. Just after he got all big and bad about no fate.
Yes. And she goes on to tell him that it's his destiny to join her. And she once again repeats that line, that phrase, it is written. Which again, this is something that we get to see echoed in other points in Star Wars, whether it's, you think about the throne room in Return of the Jedi, it's in the throne room Rise of Skywalker, where we get to see these Darksiders using this notion of fate and destiny.
Right. Prophecies.
To try and win over someone that they're trying to turn, and basically telling them that it is your destiny to join, it's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And we get another flashback. Really interesting stuff that happens in the episode with time, where we keep moving back and forth.
Right. Almost like we're getting thrown around, just like poor Tsubaki.
Yes, yeah. It's a very almost non-linear type of story. In this flashback, we get to see Tsubaki talking with presumably some sort of Jedi master. Maybe it's his master. It's not very clear. And the master is warning Tsubaki not to return to the planet. So basically, we learn that this is him making the decision to go back to help Misa.
Right. Before the stubble, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Stubble, Tsubaki.
And the master warns Tsubaki that if he returns, he will be tempted by the dark side.
Right.
And that he will not be able to help him.
Right. I think it's interesting that Tsubaki probably assumes that he means Misa, like he'll be tempted by love.
Right.
Which is ultimately not what goes down.
It's almost reminiscent, their conversation, a little bit of Luke and Obi-Wan and Empire before Luke leaves, where Obi-Wan has the whole line about, if you're going to face Vader, you're going to do it alone. I can't interfere.
Right.
So this master is telling Tsubaki essentially the same thing. If you go, you'll be in this peril and I won't be able to do anything to help you.
Yeah.
So it's at this moment that Tsubaki kind of enters this fugue state almost.
Yeah, it's like the vision takes over.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, and I mentioned how when I first watched Akakiri, I was, for whatever reason, maybe it was because I've watched a bunch of episodes in a row or whatnot, I checked out a little bit on watching Akakiri. So when we got to this bit, I didn't totally know what was going on.
Right, yes. It was very, the episode name Akakiri means red haze. And that is kind of how I felt watching it the first time. Like you're trapped in this haze, this force vision with him, and you have no freaking clue what is going on.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is intentional, where they are particularly in this moment trying to blur the line between, is this a vision or is this actually happening?
Right. And because Tsubaki doesn't really know.
Yes. Yeah. So the episode is trying to put us in his state of mind, which it does by literally going into the first person, mm-hmm. where we're seeing things as he sees them. And so while he's in this whatever mental state, he fights off several of Masago's guards, and he takes out one of them, and it turns out to be Misa in a mask.
Yeah.
And as we learn, it is the fulfillment of the vision that he was having all throughout the episode.
Right.
So the figure that he was seeing, because he even tells the master in this flashback that he keeps having this vision of killing someone over and over and over.
Right.
And we now learn that what he was seeing was him killing Misa.
Ugh, it's so sad.
It really is.
Oh, it's a gut puncher. Like, seriously, when I watched it again, I'm like, oh, oh, they're in love.
Yes.
Curse you, Star Wars. No one mm-hmm. can be happy.
Yeah. No, not allowed in Star Wars. And Masago tells Tsubaki, as he is basically at the feet of his fallen loved one, that she can bring Misa back to life if Tsubaki joins her. Mm. And Tsubaki subsequently pledges himself to Masago, and they kind of join their powers, essentially. It's not really elaborated what is going on here,
no.
But they somehow connect, and they use that to revive Misa.
Yes.
And then the episode ends with Tsubaki leaving with Masago on a Star Destroyer.
Right. Putting his hood up. Misa's like, what have you done? He's like, what I had to do.
Yes. And the music here is very, very visceral and intense.
Yes.
With the drumming and the chanting.
I felt overwhelmed. Very, very just like, ugh.
Yes.
I felt bad, folks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even on rewatch, I felt bad. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's where the episode ends. It's very abrupt. It's very dark. Mm-hmm.
I think that's what shocked me the most on the first watch. It's like, what? This is how they're going to end?
Yeah, I did not see them ending on that particular note. And I think that was a lot of people's reactions to Akakiri.
Mm-hmm. Now that I think about it, I think it was the perfect way to end
mm-hmm.
visions, especially when you do the rewatch. You start with the duel, which is very similar to Akakiri in its relative darkness.
Yeah.
And ambiguity of what's going on. And Masago is another very intriguing female villain
mm-hmm.
who has a lot of power, who seemingly seems like she has been sending these visions to Tsubaki. Mm. It seems like she's manipulating things a little bit to her advantage. I do like that she basically gives the middle finger to Palpy and is like, I bring people back from the dead and like nothing. This is amazing. I did like that. But yeah, they're very similar. I think they ended up being good bookends. Just on that first watch, it was very odd. Like, it felt very odd.
Yeah, I agree. It's not a conventional Star Wars ending.
Right. It's very Empire, but without the Luke and Leia hug at the end.
Exactly.
This is like if they had chosen to just end it after Han was frozen in carbonite and yes. taken away.
It's basically like, Ben, why didn't you tell me? And then it just cuts to the credits.
Yep. Exactly.
That's like, basically Akakiri.
Oof, that's a downer.
Yeah, it's a very unconventional Star Wars ending because we're used to ending, even with our quote-unquote darker middle chapters, mm-hmm. we're used to ending on a higher note. Because as you mentioned, right. Empire does that with the Luke and Leia scene. Last Jedi does that with the we have everything we need.
Yes.
So there's always the ending of even if things aren't in a great place, there's still that hope
right.
out there.
And here, oof.
Yeah. Yeah, here it's like, what's going to happen next?
Right. Like, the only hope there might be is that Misa and Tsubaki do love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be possibly the only thing that could bring him back. And that's all I can think.
Like, yeah.
Otherwise, there's nothing happy about this.
Yeah, you're totally right. Yeah, there's really no other flicker of hope in the episode.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess they left. Like, yes. Misa's probably going to be the queen now because Masako left. But then she'll have it hanging over her head like, well, what is my boyfriend doing?
Yep. So, yeah, so Tsubaki enters basically the Holy Trinity with Anakin and Elzar Man of moody hot Jedi,
the dark side.
Played with visions, mm-hmm. overly hung up on their crushes from years past.
Good Lord. Freaking Elzar. Jesus.
God.
He needs to calm down.
Yes, he does.
He won't, but that's fine.
Oh, God.
I did like this episode on the rewatch a lot more than when I first watched it. I really appreciated the animation style. It was very different
mm-hmm.
from anything else. And the studio that did this one was Science Saru, and they also did Toby. They also did T0B1, which is pretty wild. So different in styles, and yet the same studio made them.
Yeah, so different in style, so different in tone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really kind of showing off a range, a spectrum there of storytelling.
And I'm guessing, like, can you imagine Disney getting pitched those two titles from the studio? Being like, okay, so this is a really cute one. It's about a robot who also is, like, attuned with the Force. It's going to be really cool. And this next one is really depressing.
God.
And Disney's like, tell me more about the depressing one.
Go on.
Yeah. Is there a dead parent? Oh, yes.
Heartbroken lovers? Good.
Check. Sidekicks that are kind of stupid? Double check.
Yes.
I just was very excited on the rewatch to be like, okay, I actually get why they put this here now.
Mm-hmm.
I understand thematically what they were going for. And it really does turn out that the back half episodes had a lot of more downer endings.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lop and Ocho, very downer. Even the Elder kind of was like, ooh, this isn't exactly happy. I mean, they survive and they defeated the Elder, but still his like dissolving body, he like exploded his ship, so there's no way for Tajin to really report back about anything.
Yeah, and even just the existential thing of Tajin, like, everyone gets old and dies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're all gonna die someday. Dan's like, thanks. Thanks for telling me that. So it ends on just these notes, were like discordant notes where you're like, oh, that was, I liked that. It was really good. It was really Star Wars. And then you think about it and you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, is Lapin Ocho's dad still alive? Do we know? Is their family destroyed? Will their planet now be destroyed? There's a lot to unpack, which I think is very similar to a lot of anime. People think that anime is either just for kids, like maybe Pokemon or Dragon Ball. And then you start to watch it and you're like, oh yeah, this is going to be a super cute, fun show about kids who want to be superheroes. And then you're like, oh, every single one of them has childhood trauma.
Yeah.
Everyone. And the storylines continually run this gamut of being silly or cute. And then all of a sudden they hit you with a gut punch of emotion and trauma. And I think Star Wars is really good at treading that water too, like with Rebels. And Clone Wars, you get that dichotomy of, oh, yeah, we have a Jar Jar episode. And then you watch Scene of Mandalore and you're like, where did my soul go? I don't know. I don't know where it is. It's gone. It's gone forever. So I think these studios just fit so well with the Disney style. Because Disney knows how to embrace darkness.
Right.
Usually the hero does win in the end. I don't expect Masako to get away with this in the long run. In anime too. I mean, they beat the villains 9 out of 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any anime that I've seen recently that ends on a super depressing note, except for, I mean, Bebop has a little bit of a depressing ending. And Banana Fish is just wholly like, I've been killed by this show. But most of them end with the hero prevailing. So I don't think any of these shorts would have the villain winning in the end.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. I think as much as they're playing and stretching with the boundaries of Star Wars, I think the heroes ultimately win is, I think if you ask any of these studios to continue fleshing out these stories, I think they would eventually sooner or later end up there.
Because mm-hmm. otherwise it's like, oof, what have we been doing?
But yeah, I mean, in terms of Akakiri, yeah, it's sort of similar to, I want to echo what you said, which is that on rewatch, I'm much more cued into some of the deeper stuff about fate and destiny, which again is very Star Wars and all the things about the extent to which the things that happen were always going to happen, or the extent to which individuals' decisions to do this or that are playing a role. I think it's playing around with a lot of those questions that Star Wars does too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think there's a lot of compelling stuff that is happening again below the surface there.
Right. Like if he hadn't gone back to the planet, this probably would not have happened. Mm-hmm. But then how can you sit back and let the love of your life be killed or be hurt? And that brings the whole Jedi thing back into it. Be like, well, you know, we're not supposed to have attachments for this very reason. And you're like, fuck you. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to hear about it anymore. Right, I don't want to hear that crap anymore, Yoda. But yes. Then you get this episode and it's like, well, you were just manipulated by a Sith Lord. I told you so. And you're like, God damn it.
Right.
This is not what I had planned on happening.
This is not how I saw this day going.
Yeah, this is not, I wasn't even supposed to work today.
I was supposed to be off, and now I'm a Sith. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, exactly. I know, that is definitely not how he figured his day would be going.
Yes.
You're like, oh, I guess I'm a Sith now. Sorry, everyone. And he did it really quickly, too. Like, he was like, yep, I'm good.
Yeah, pretty much.
Bring her back to life. I don't care about anything else. You're like, oh, God.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, man. But yes, I enjoyed it. I'm going to have to redo my rankings again. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It's going to be interesting.
All right. So I have, as kind of to close out our discussion of Visions overall, I have mm-hmm. two questions for you okay. as the resident anime person here.
Checking in.
Yes. So, you know, as we know, Visions was this collaborative project where you have all of these different studios getting this opportunity to tell their own stories. So if and when we get future anime storytelling in Star Wars, whether that's a season 2, whether that's, let's say, a short film that gets done in anime, is there any anime studio that you would like to see take on Star Wars that wasn't represented here?
Ooh, that's, dang. That's a tough question. I would say I am really into My Hero Academia right now. So Studio Bones would be a big one I'd like to see.
Mm-hmm.
I really like their aesthetic. I really like how they do storylines. They were really good at adapting the manga from My Hero Academia. I know some people would disagree with me on that, but I really think they were good at grasping the story and how they wanted to do it. And it just worked out really well. Otherwise, I think like Studio Mappa would be really good. They're currently doing the final season of Attack on Titan. They didn't start out doing the anime version of that, but I think they've taken it on and have done a really good job with it. And they're also good at depressing as all hell anime, which is Attack on Titan to a T. they would be great to see. Gainax would be another one that would be cool. They did Evangelion. I'm trying to think who else would be really good. Considering like directors, I think Shinichiro Watanabe would be great. He is the creator of Cowboy Bebop. I think he would bring kind of an interesting feel to it just because he's done the found family in space thing. He knows what he's doing with that kind of genre, and he would give us that kind of Firefly roommates in space, roommates okay. trying to get along in space, which I think would be really fun for Star Wars, which they kind of did in Rebels. Like they did yes. the whole found family, we're roommates, we have to try and get along. But I could do a more like slice of life kind of Star Wars situation in that vein. I think that would be really fun.
All right. And actually, your comments there very nicely transition to my second question that I'm going to ask you. So one of the things that we've talked about over the course of both of our two-part discussions of Visions are various anime tropes and story elements. So I'm curious if there's any anime, either subgenre or story type or anything like that, that you would like to see a Star Wars story told in.
Ooh, that's really fun. They did a lot with Visions, actually. They did like the samurai story. They did kind of a shonen protagonist story. They did the found family. They did the band anime. We need a sports anime now. Sports Star Wars anime. I mean, anime and Star Wars go so well together because they latch on to that kind of hero's journey perspective. But I'd like to see them go further, like with Lop, I think would be great. You don't get a lot of hero's journeys with a female lead. Mm-hmm. Like we have Rey, and she's great. But then I'd like to see them push the boundary even farther and make it an alien protagonist.
Yeah.
Who's also a female character. I think that'd be really fun. Especially when you're focusing on sisters and there isn't necessarily a love interest involved. It's just trying to get your sister back.
Yeah.
I think that would be great. I think a caravan kind of situation in space would be cool. Like I recommended Outbound Flight before. And that's about partially about a giant kind of generational ship that's going past the Outer Rim and trying to go into the unknown regions. I think that would be kind of cool to get a slice of life on this giant ship of all these people trying to live together on the ship while they're moving to different planets. I think that'd be kind of cool to see in anime. And then if you want to throw the Chiss in, great. Never mad to get more Chiss content.
Yes.
I think that would be really fun. For other anime tropes, can we get, like, someone controlling creatures? Maybe not controlling, but, like, just good enough with the Force that they can communicate with creatures, like Ezra. Yeah. But maybe, like, even more connected than that. Mm-hmm. Like, give us a Star Wars Pokemon kind of situation.
Okay.
That'd be kind of cute. I don't know if you could do, like, a whole series about that, but maybe, like, a new short if they do a season two of Visions. That'd be kind of cool to throw in.
That would
be, like, we like a cute sidekick for sure.
Yes, we do.
Otherwise, like, go full frickin' Kurosawa. Like, give us an epic, completely Japanese style, like the duel.
Yeah.
And like the scenario we had in Lop and Ocho. Like, really lean into that.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, yes, this is what we're doing, and it's Star Wars, and it's still good.
Yes.
I would love to see that.
Yeah. All right. So that wraps up our discussion of Visions across two episodes. Thank you, Colleen, for joining me for this.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. This was so fun. I love doing deep dives.
We've talked about Visions now collectively for 4 hours.
And we could talk more.
Yes, we could. So the final thing, which is I should have done in the first part, but totally forgot about because I'm a bad host, which is to give you an opportunity to plug your stuff. Where can people find you? I'm so sorry.
Yes. No, you're good. You're good. We can be found. Well, I should say, should I start with me first or should I? I can do
however you want to do it. It is up to you.
I'll do the pods that I help co-host, Bohemian Geek Studies, and yet another Star Wars podcast. Both of them you can find like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you find your podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Colleen Writes MN, which is Colleen Writes Minnesota, because that's where I'm from. I'll probably be posting a lot there fairly soon. My second novel is being published in this winter, so I will be a little bit more active on Twitter. I'm not exactly sure when it's coming out. I'd give you a date. I think it's going to be early December. And it's called The Falls. It's kind of Stephen King-y horror, like small town shenanigans horror situation. And I'm very excited for that to come out. And that is pretty much it for me. I'm trying to think of anything else we have. BohemianGeekStudies.com. You can find my Star Wars writing. I did a very long essay on Ezra Bridger. I think it clocked in at 11 to 12 pages, just about Ezra. And then I have a bunch of Star Wars book reviews. I read over 50 Star Wars novels in 2020. So I did reviews for all of those.
All right. Well, thank you again, Colleen, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Devor. This is just so fun. I love talking about Star Wars, love talking about anime. Basically, it was like, whew.
Yeah, it has been a fantastic journey through Vision. So I'm so glad that we got to do this.
Me too.
So what to expect on the next episode? Episode 29 will drop on November 15th. And in that episode, I will be talking Star Wars planets. More specifically, I will be giving my list, my ranking of my 10 favorite planets in the saga. So be sure to tune in for that. Until then, make sure you're subscribed to the show. Please rate and review the show if you're able to do so. If you're not already following the show on Twitter, you can do so at A Larger View Pod. You can also follow me on Twitter at Demondum. And until next time, look for the Force, and you will always find it.